Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 32 of the Theatrical Mustang podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This is an interview with local actor and playwright Brandon J. Simmons. He's written a new play called Is She Dead Yet?, which he's directing for Annex Theater, and it opens July 31st. It's called A White Comedy, and it explores privilege in America, and this was a really fascinating and provocative interview. I think you're really going to enjoy it. This episode is sponsored by KLM XYZ Creative Communications. Visit their website at klmxyz.com. All right, enjoy episode 32 with Brandon J. Simmons. All right, I'm very excited to welcome Brandon J. Simmons to the podcast. Well, so welcome, Brandon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So we're here to talk about an exciting new play that you wrote and are directing at Annex Theater called Is She Dead Yet?
That's right.
Provocative title. Tell me more about this play. Where did it come from?
The play came from Euripides' play Alcestis, which is a play that I know really well and have loved for many years, and is a play about a woman who sacrifices her life for her husband. And over the course of that play, the husband, she dies very early in the play, and the rest of the play is him really coming to grips with his place in society, his place in the universe, and coming to the realization, depending on how you read it, that it doesn't work to have someone die for you. And when I was reading the play, one thing that struck me in, I'm very interested in exploring whiteness and white privilege, being an artist of color, a queer artist of color. And so I'm always, lately at least, I'm always viewing movies, reading television through that lens, theater, watching theater through that lens of examining white privilege and identifying where it's at play. And so in rereading Alcestis, which I do every now and then, it struck me that Admetus, the guy, the king in this play, is a man who doesn't understand his privilege. And I'd been having so many conversations with white friends about white privilege where I was coming to the limits of my ability to communicate about white privilege.
Right.
And they were bumping up against their limitations of seeing their own privilege, that I suddenly saw Alcestis in this new light, that Alcestis is a play about a man who doesn't understand his privilege and the unworkability of a society built on a blindness to privilege. So when I started to adapt it into this play, I wanted to stay really close to Euripides' plot because it's a masterful plot. The plot is, I won't get into that too much because I could talk for an hour just about Euripides' plot, but it's an absolutely phenomenal play. It's a play where it's like Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, where everything cancels everything else out.
Right.
And the structure of Alcestis is a zero sum, so that it deals with hypocrisy and two-facedness in a way that annihilates meaning within the play itself. And the plot veers from black to white in terms of, rhetorically, from black to white, where you'll get to know a character and you'll have an opinion of this character, and then someone will come on stage and obliterate your opinion of that character while also exposing their own hypocrisy at the same time. So it's a play that really demands that an audience hold one and zero in their head at all times. It's like a tightrope or a razor's edge. So when I wanted to, that's why when I adapted Alcestis into Is She Dead Yet, I wanted to stick with that plot because he achieves something almost mathematically with the plot that I just wanted to steal. I trusted that there was a wisdom in that plotting and that I could use that plot then to basically explore whiteness as opposed to blackness. When I started, it wasn't a race play. It was just a play about a woman who sacrifices her life in modern America. And it was going to be a play about this unhappy woman, you know, who was failed by the idea of marriage and failed by the idea of family and who's failed by this whole society and chose to end her life rather than live in this world anymore. And because Euripides explores extremes in all of his plays, I wanted to explore extremes. And so I started to look at how can we tease out the extremes of this world. So I thought, well, what if she's a black woman who's sacrificing her life for her white husband? That would be an interesting scenario. We could explore why would a black woman sacrifice her life for her white husband. And then it occurred to me that if we're playing with extremes, and everything in this play is extreme, everything. This is, we're on the planet America. It's not the country America. It's the planet America, in which there are only white people and black people, right? It's white and black. Everything in the play is these sort of Euripidean ones and zeros, white and black, these elements, these elemental forces at odds. And so that's when I thought, well, what if she's the last black person on Earth, sacrificing her life for her white husband? Now, of course, that means that once she's dead, we live in an all-white world.
Right.
And one of the facets of white privilege is the idea of the all-white community. When we talk about good schools, we talk about good neighborhoods. That's code for white schools and white neighborhoods, if you're white and middle class. And a lot of people don't even realize that they're saying that. But there is this expectation that a good neighborhood is a white neighborhood, and the whiter the better. So there's no sense of loss at the diversity in these communities. And so it was an opportunity to explore the ultimate all-white community and what happens to whiteness and what happens to white privilege when the other is removed from the equation entirely, where there is no more zeros, it's all ones, or there's no more ones and it's all zeros. And it's sort of like this compass that spins out of control, and there's this breakdown of memory and a breakdown of meaning in this world, because without an oppressor or without an oppressed, the oppression reverts back onto the oppressor, right? And meaning completely breaks down. And it's a comedy. And it's really important that I emphasize that, because this stuff gets really heavy really fast.
Absolutely.
You know, with Trayvon Martin and with Eric Garner and with Mike Brown and with Tamir Rice and with Black Lives Matter, all of that in the background, and this shooting in Charleston, all of that, with all of that in the background, it gets really heavy and really dire really fast. And as an artist, I'm interested in comedy because it reveals the truth while also entertaining, which is so important. I don't want to ask people to sit in a theater in the middle of a beautiful summer and feel guilty about their white privilege. I want to invite people into a theater this summer to laugh at their white privilege and to learn something about how it functions in the world through that laughter.
This all sounds absolutely amazing.
I think it is pretty amazing. You know, and I credit a lot of that with, again, with Euripides, because he laid the groundwork for this play. And my job, in a sense, was really easy. It was to go through and to really start to translate, to find a structure, to receive the structure from Euripides, to have an idea for the lens I wanted to view it through, and just find those, to find those images and those symbols that translate into a modern race play. And to explore a topic that a lot of people aren't very familiar with, which is whiteness, which is something that there's a lot of ignorance about whiteness, including my own. You know, I don't claim to be an expert on whiteness, but I am in a sense, because I'm a light-skinned mixed-race person who's constructed a pretty white life, spent his whole life really observing whiteness, kind of unconsciously. But in the last year, in the writing of this play and in looking at the national conversation around race, I've come to realize I actually am kind of an expert on whiteness, because who better to understand it than a black man who can pass for white? I understand a lot of the way that whiteness functions and a lot of the dysfunction of whiteness.
That's really powerful.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's actually it's an important step in the conversation about race to look at and to expose whiteness for what it is, which I think is, it's a large structure. The perception I have is that we view whiteness as a complex of privileges that certain people have and that are denied to other people, to people of color, not just black people, but illegal immigrants, Mexican people, people from Asia, people from all over, people, anyone who's identified as an other. But my observation is that whiteness is actually a structure in which we all are being played, including white people. And the problem I have with this idea that whiteness is a thing that white people have, and that now it's time to share that with everyone, those privileges, is that overlooks the dysfunction of whiteness, and it overlooks the pain and the suffering inside of whiteness, which I mentioned just to highlight that the suffering of white communities, the suffering of all white communities, that's not something that we want to share with people of color. The dysfunctions in the white family, you know, and the robbing of self-expression and freedom there's the very common joke that white people can't dance, which is such a common joke as to just, we can sort of brush it aside as this kind of tired old meme.
Sure.
But I observe that as actually a really important thing to observe, that in the white community, in communities that don't have a positive cultural expression, there is a lack of self, there's a lack of expression, and there is an imprisonment in people's bodies, and there's an inhibition in the body. And I think that identifying that suffering and saying, look, white people suffer under whiteness, and black people also suffer under whiteness. So yeah, I'd say that part of identifying how whiteness works is identifying how we are all, to some extent, puppets in this larger structure, this power structure that has its own agenda, and that's using white bodies, that's using black bodies, you know, and you can tie it into all different kinds of political, capitalism, this and that, religion, yada, yada, yada. But the fact is, as human beings, we are living inside of these structures. And when we become conscious of them, when we expose them for what they are, we can become free of them. So what my play tries to do is to say, this is whiteness. This is what whiteness looks like. This is how whiteness functions. Isn't it hilarious? Isn't it absurd? Isn't it crazy? Isn't it painful? Isn't it? And to really just ask those questions and invite an audience to laugh at them and hopefully learn something, anything from them.
Right. Can you talk about your writing process, since it's an adaptation? Do you sit down at the same time every day? Or does it come in spurts? How do you approach playwriting?
I'm developing myself as a playwright right now. I've been a writer for longer than I've been an actor, but professionally I've acted for much longer than I've written. I think, like a lot of writers, I've kept my writing to myself for many, many years, and it's only starting to see the light of day. I've had one other play produced at Annex Theatre a few years ago, The Tale of Jemima Kennard, which was, I think, a little less successful at dealing with race. And so I'm watching the way that I've developed. I'm in the middle of developing. I mean, when I was writing this play, it was really important that I really understood Euripides' play inside and out. So I read many translations of his plays. Last summer, I just spent the whole summer really reading essays about Euripides and just trying to get really a crash course. I never really studied the Greeks. A crash course in how Euripides works and how his plays function. And reading other plays by him. And for this play, I got really lit up pretty quickly. And the first act came in a very quick burst. And then it was a good 6 months before I started the second act. But then once I started the second act, it came in a very quick burst as well. The funny thing is, now that this play is finished, I've gotten very serious about writing new plays. So I've started a new script. I've started a couple new scripts where I am now writing on a regular schedule every day, every morning. That's fallen away a bit now that I'm in rehearsal.
Sure.
Just because we rehearse until 10:30 at Annex, and so I'm not in bed till midnight, and so I'm needing to get my sleep a little bit later in the morning. So that's how it is now. And I feel there's a lot of wisdom out there that's, you know, if you're a serious writer, you've got to write a certain amount every day and do this or that. And that's not for me. I can do that for a bit, and then I'll produce, you know, say 60 really good pages. And then I've got to set it aside, and then it'll come in. You know, I find that once I get that first sort of chunk, then it goes away. It's got to sit for a little bit. It's got to sit for a couple of months. And I won't do anything for those couple of months, you know. And it's just a game of how quickly can I get over the guilt of not writing.
Right.
Because I've started to see that that's actually part of the process. Part of the process is writing really methodically for a month or two. And then putting it away for maybe 6 months.
Letting it breathe.
Yeah, and that's why it's good to have other projects, you know, because it lets that, I find that I also play the piano, and it's an interesting thing about the creative process that I'm learning is that time of stepping away from it is just as, if not even more valuable than the time you actually spend writing it, because it's my brain and my heart and my body and my whole mind is working on that material at all times. And I've got that sense now for this new script, which is sitting, and it's been sitting for about 6 weeks now. And it's that exciting thing when I feel that it's sort of quietly nagging at me and calling and excited for when this show will open, because then I can get back to it. And that's, I've learned to really trust that feeling and to actually sort of let it nag. And the longer it nags, the I know that work is getting done, so that when I get back to it, there's going to be a breakthrough. That's very exciting.
Can you talk about your relationship, the relationship between acting and playwriting, and how you experience that as an artist?
Yeah, well, I mean, I know that I write plays that actors love to act. That's the real benefit of having spent so much time as an actor, is I have just total access to, I think, a kind of language that is naturally exciting for an actor to speak. We all know, as actors, what it feels like to have boring roles where you don't get to do anything exciting, or where you're just a function, in a plot function. And of course, not every single role in the two complete plays that I've written are actors throwing themselves out to play. Not all of them are huge, meaty roles. But I do think that in terms of hearing a voice that is naturally actorly and exciting for an actor to speak is just something that comes naturally to me, because I've been an actor. That said, it's infinitely easier to write plays than to act in them. Now that I'm directing, now that I've done a bunch of producing of theater with the Seagull Project, and I've written, and now I'm directing for the first time, my respect for actors is only increasing, because it is by far the hardest of those jobs to do. It's just even getting through a rehearsal, bringing that energy to a rehearsal, and what it takes, and the mental energy it takes, even when you're not at a rehearsal, the way that your brain is working.
It's your entire subconscious.
It is. It's all lit up, and it's all bound up in the ego in a way that it's not with writing and directing. Right. There's plenty of ego in directing as well. I think less so in writing, at least for me. I'm a much more confident writer than I am anything else. But acting is tough. It's a tough job. And some people joked, there's that silly list that came out that said acting was, I think, the most stressful job to have, and including a list of firefighters and, you know, EMTs. And a lot of people were like, well, that's silly. That's funny. I don't know what they're referring to in terms of that stress. It's certainly not as stressful as running into a burning building. I've never run into a burning building, but I have acted for many years. And my fiance can attest to the stress that he experiences when I'm in tech. It is a great deal of stress when you feel that your ego and your body is your instrument and on the line and being judged. It's a great deal of stress, not to mention the work it takes to support the lifestyle of an actor, because almost all actors are working several jobs and getting paid very little. So, of course, it's not a contest about actors have it harder than firefighters, but actors have a very difficult job, I think.
What's it been? So this is the first show you've directed?
Yeah, I've directed littler projects, smaller readings and things like that. And I directed a production in college, you know, 15 years ago. But this is essentially the first time I've worked with designers and a theater and had a budget and been able to really call the shots.
Let's dig into that a little bit. So first of all, casting, what was it like casting a play that you wrote? I mean, you must have had a very specific eye for what you were looking for.
I did. And the fun thing about casting is I came in with very specific ideas for what people should look like, and, you know, even specific actors who should play this or that role. But once you get actors in front of you, right, of course you invite some actors to audition, and then you call in a bunch of actors who come, who you don't even know, who come in. And once you have actors in front of you, it's a whole new ballgame. It's an entirely new ballgame, because, you let go of a lot of your preconceptions. You become so grateful for what actors do, because every actor brings something new to the role that you couldn't have imagined before. And so, casting this show was actually really, really easy, mainly because I got a lot of really great actors to choose from. And that's been really great. Yeah, casting is tough work, but it's fun because it's just inspiring. It inspires me in terms of what human beings do and how human beings play with their selves, you know? And I mean, like, in that sense of, like, you have a self and actors play with that. That's the thing they play with in front of you. And it brings this whole new dimension to the work.
Tell me about your cast.
Oh, great. Yeah, we've got some fantastic actors in our cast. The thing about this show that I'm really excited about is the chorus. Every Greek play, of course, has a chorus. And our chorus is a family of four nosy neighbors, a mother, a father, and two teenage sons, who immediately forget who they are. They forget how to be a family in this world. And the chorus really gets to explore this idea of the middle class white family, and what I see as kind of a breakdown in affinity and a breakdown in communication within that kind of family. And they're played by Tom Wisely and Paige Clark and Shane Regan and Soren Gillespie. And they, all four of them, bring completely different qualities. You know, the dad is kind of disenchanted with the family. The mom is still trying to keep up appearances. You know, the one kid is very sweet and innocent and wide-eyed. The other kid is more cynical and always looking at Reddit and, you know, dresses in black and this and that. And they speak in these very short, punchy, rhythmic lines. And they shuffle around on the stage like a school of fish. They're fantastic. And they're so game, and I'm so hard on them. I'm very hard on them because they've got the hardest job in the play.
Right.
They've got to play like a little chamber orchestra for the whole thing, and it's so tight. And they just roll with the punches. It's wonderful. They inspire me completely. Alex Matthews and Jesenia Iglesias are playing the husband and wife. Jesenia is the wife who sacrifices her life. Alex is her husband, the mayor of Mini Salt Lake in the North Woods, a small town on the planet America. And he's the man who doesn't understand the sacrifice she's making. He doesn't understand his own privilege. Alex is just an effortlessly natural actor. He just brings all of this spontaneity and charisma and elegance to the work that is just extremely exciting. Hannah Victoria Franklin is playing the Heracles character. In Alcestis, Heracles comes halfway through the play and changes things up and really takes the plot in a new direction. And I knew I wanted Hannah to play this role, and I actually talked with her a year ago. She's the one actor who I hooked up with early on, and I essentially wrote this role for her. The Heracles in this world is Clea. Her name is Clea Nike Powermore, and she's a hip-hop artist, astronaut, marine adventurer, interplanetary covert ops agents, Grammy-winning, Emmy-winning reality star. She's every kind of badass female celebrity that you can imagine. Ninja warrior, Xena warrior princess meets Buffy the Vampire Slayer type of person. And Hannah she's created an original hip-hop number, which she'll perform in Act 2 of the play. She just brings an entirely different dimension to everything. I've worked with her many times over the years. Let's see, who else do we have in the cast? We've got Danny Suter, who plays Death, and a reporter who... a very funny reporter, a very funny performance about a reporter who has amnesia and goes blind in this world, you know, where meaning starts to break down. And I know I'm forgetting... Oh, John Ray. John Ray I worked with in one of my first shows here in Seattle. We did Camino Reel with Theater Simple, which is one of the best plays I've ever been in, directed by Karis Kresny. And John just has one big meaty scene in Act 2. I can't say too much about him because he's just an effortlessly watchable actor. And he plays this crusty old father, he plays Alex Matthews' father. This character who comes out in Act 2 and just sort of exposes his son's hypocrisy and exposes his son's weaknesses in this hugely comic, devastatingly comic way. Carol Thompson is playing the maid. And the maid in Alcestis, there's a character of the maid who comes out and delivers a messenger speech, who tells us about how Alcestis received the news that she was going to die. And she gives a long speech about the nobility of her receiving this information and how she performed these last rites for herself and her family. And then in Act 2, there's a servant who comes out and delivers another long speech. So I combine these characters into one character of the maid. And it's a really interesting character because she starts to look like the working class white person in this new world where meaning has broken down, where there are no black people. She starts to see that there's a new bottom rung of the ladder, and it's the unpaid intern. She's the unpaid menial intern, so she's essentially a kind of slave in this new world, and so there's this element of class to it. And Carol, she's a fantastic actor, and she brings, like Hannah, in some respects, she brings something that is completely undefinable and unexpected to everything she says. So, yeah, it's a great cast.
Let's talk about your design team.
Yes, let's talk. I've got some very fresh faces, which is very exciting to work with designers who are fresh out of school because they're coming out of this sort of marathon of training.
They have a hunger, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so we've got Kenny Dutton on sets and Adam Zopfi-Hals, who are both just recent grads out of Cornish. Adam is doing our costumes. They've both got a great sense of style, and they've got a great working relationship, this very dynamic relationship, which is why I'm really happy that I got both of them, because they've got this history together. Ryan Dunn will be doing our lights. It's great working with Ryan because he's just he's very calm. He has this sense of, you know, everything's going to be handled. Every idea you have is a great idea. And I know that he's processing and working. He's great working with him. And then the sound actually is really exciting. It's actually a duo who've created a lot of work together. Andy Samora, who works on at the Can-Can, and Hannah Victoria Franklin, who's in the cast. And they're working together to create the soundscape for the show. And there's going to be this great combination of these sort of Greek drums and cymbal crashes and things, a sort of very ritualistic Greek theater stuff, juxtaposed with the hip-hop sounds. And we're using some music from Prokofiev, and looping that music. And there's going to be some very exciting sounds happening.
So the show opens July 31st.
That's right.
People are going to want to go to annextheater.org to yes. get all of the tickets and all that stuff. What's it been like working with Annex since you've worked with them before?
I've worked with them before. It's fantastic. There's no theater in Seattle that does what Annex does. There's no other theater in Seattle where a playwright like me, who's mostly untested, and a director who's entirely untested, can demonstrate a hunger and a passion for material and then just get the full support of this theater. And it's a place where you really get to do your thing. There are very few restrictions. And so that kind of support, and to have a theater space in the middle of Capitol Hill where I can essentially just try something really big and daring is a miracle. There are just so few hurdles. You know, the only hurdle right now at Annex is they're getting more and more popular. And so they're getting more and more submissions because I think more and more artists are seeing that it's a place where artists get to develop their voices, whether that be as directors or as actors or as writers. So it's been really great. And in the support of Pamela Miatov, the artistic director, who's so smart and who asks all the right questions, and my production manager, Katie McKellar, and Noelle Wilcox, who've just been offered fantastic support. And even up to the managing director, Stephen McCandless, it's just, I feel supported by every single member. And because they're a democratic collective and everyone votes on, it's not just up to the artistic director and a board, you know that everyone in that theater is on board with your project. You know, if you're in that building, you know everyone signed off on it. And that's just a brilliant way to set up your theater, I think. It inspires confidence.
Let's go back in time.
Okay.
And talk about your origin story as a performer, as a theater artist.
Oh, my hallowed origin story.
It's very Greek, right? Yeah. We're talking about that. Do you remember, what's the first memory of performing or being at a performance that really resonated with you and you were like, this is something I gotta keep doing with my life?
My aunt, my mother's younger sister, Nicole, is only 4 years older than I am. She was a late surprise from my grandmother. And so she was like a big sister to me, and she always did tap and ballet and that kind of thing. And we always went to dance recitals, which was fun because she was in them, but I could have dealt without, you know, I didn't have to sit through the rest of it. But she also did theater. It was two things. One is she would come over every time she learned the new Janet Jackson video at her hip hop dance class. She'd come over, grandma would come for a visit and bring Nicole. And Nicole and my brother and I would disappear into the bedroom and she would choreograph a number that we would set to a Weird Al Yankovic or the new Michael Jackson.
Nice.
And we would write a script, you know, so we would do a skit. It would be a whole skit that we'd put together in like an hour or 2 hours in the bedroom. And then we'd come out and we'd do it for the parents and grandma. And of course everyone loved it. Or we'd do, you know, that Sesame Street album, you know, C is for Cookie, or
right.
I Lost Me Cookie on the Disco, or something like that, you know, or Weird Al. So that was my first experience of performing and just the delight of creating something. It never occurred to me that it was a job until I saw Nicole do The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at her, you know, some cruddy little performance of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at her middle school. And there was a moment she played the witch, the White Witch, and at some point she was meant to hit, you know, her dwarf servant over the head, and she hit him, and she accidentally hit his, he was wearing like a crown or something on his head, and she hit it, and it went flying into the audience. And it was the funniest, most unexpected thing, and that was that perfect moment of seeing both the thrill of a theater piece happen in front of you, and then that extra thrill of something accidental and brilliant happening in the moment. And that was really the first time when I thought, this is something I need to do. And so then I was the guy in junior high and high school who did all the plays. I was the only guy who did all the plays. There were plenty of girls who did all the plays, but I was the only guy. And then did it all through college, didn't major in it.
What did you major in?
English. Like I said, creative writing. I was always a writer. And acting was really a hobby. I thought I would be a writer. But then I wanted to, you know, I graduated with the English degree, and I knew I'd regret not training as an actor. And I was able to find a one-year actor training program in Liverpool, England, where I could actually just train, do all of the training, kind of a crash course in Meisner and Stanislavski. And of course, it's England, so there's just fantastic vocal work and, you know, period dance and movement, Alexander technique, all of that stuff in a year. And a year is not enough to really dig into that material, but it is enough to get something on my resume and start to teach me something about how to actually create a career. And that's really what got me started. And then I moved to Seattle after that. And Seattle's a very welcoming place, at least it has been for me.
What have been some of your favorite roles that you've played?
That first, it wasn't the first show I did, but it was, I think, the third show I did in Seattle was Camino Reel, Tennessee Williams Camino Reel with Theater Simple, Andrew Litsky and Lisa Holland's company. And it was a big cast, and it was where I met my sort of artistic soulmate, who's since moved away, Karis Kresny, who's as close to a mentor in the theater as I've ever had. And she cast me as four roles in that play, I think, and I ended up poaching a fifth role from a different actor, which I hope they don't have any bad blood over that still. But I got to play the Baron de Charlieu. The Camino Reel is just this collection of misfits from different literary genres, you know, Casanova and Camille and Mr. Gutman, I think, from The Maltese Falcon, and the Baron de Charlieu from Proust. And I also played Lord Byron, who tells the story of when Shelley was killed at sea. And it's just a weird sort of fever dream of a play. I loved doing that. And then I'm hugely proud of the two plays that the Seagull Project has done, The Seagull and The Three Sisters, where I really feel like our productions have been able to find the humor in Chekhov that really connects with an audience that many of people who didn't know that Chekhov was funny or that Chekhov was even remotely enjoyable at all. And that's why our company exists, because we believe in Chekhov, and we believe that there's so many misconceptions about who he is and what his work means. And thankfully also we have John Langs as our resident director, who also has just this fiercely flamboyant theatricality, which, you know, I think with our productions, which he actually tamps down for our productions, but just enough of that to really explode it into a theater space. So we've got that, just that lovely line between the simplicity and the subtlety of Chekhov and the big colors and the big gestures of John Langs, and then the humor, getting all of that to an audience, you know. And yeah, and, oh, well, I did this Hamlet last fall at New City Theater. So I just have started discovering New City Theater, John Kazanjian and Mary Ewald, who just do, just no one else does what they do. The simplicity of their work just is hugely inspiring, hugely inspiring. And then I'd say the other production that really stands out for me is Sextet at Washington Ensemble Theater. in 2010, I think. That's where I met Hannah Franklin, Hannah Victoria Franklin. And I got to work with Roger Bennington, who's a director who I've really, whose work I really admire, who no one else who I've worked with is really doing the very crystal clear, pristine, very specific work that he's doing. Almost hermetic sort of cleanliness to his productions that I really, really love. And actually has inspired my work on this play quite a bit.
What's on your bucket list as both an actor and a playwright? What roles do you want to play? What themes do you want to write about?
I'm having what we call a good year this year. I got the most unexpected surprise of my life in theater so far at a pretty young age. I've always wanted to play Salieri in Amadeus. It's been my dream role since I saw the movie in at age 12 and learned it was a play. And I've been recently cast as Salieri in the production of Amadeus that's coming up at Seattle Public Theater.
Congratulations!
Thank you. It's literally a dream come true, and it's not often that an actor gets to say that. So that's like a major. That's the only role that I said I had to play before I died, and barring this huge earthquake that's going to destroy us all between now and February, I will get to play that role. There are so many Shakespeare's that I'd love to play. I'd love to play Cassius in Julius Caesar. Mm. I think one day I'd love to play Claudius in Hamlet. And there are others. There was one other. What was the other one I'm thinking of? I can't remember now. But it's funny. There aren't a lot of roles that I really, really want to play in theater. I just know that I'm mostly interested in the classics, meaning stuff, before 1910. That sort of classic Greek through European tradition of all that. The stuff that doesn't have a lot of the baggage of American drama in the mid-century to the present, even though that's what I'm writing. My sensibilities as a writer are very different. As a writer, I've got a bucket list. I want to adapt The Marriage of Figaro. I want to adapt... the big one is a sort of play that is a dramatic expression of Johann Sebastian Bach's Goldberg Variations, which is a monumental piece of music that I want to adapt into a play. I'm into structure. Like, when there's a certain structure for something, right, that's what really inspires me. And without getting into it, the Goldberg Variations has this unbelievably intricate structure. And it is structured also like a theater piece in a very subtle and also very overt way. So Figaro, Mozart's Marriage of Figaro is one of my touchstones for really great theater. And so, of course, that's based on Beaumarchais. And there's other Greek stuff that I'd love to adapt. I'm really interested in children's literature. And that's my first play, The Tale of Jemima Kennard, was based on The Tale of Jemima Puddle Duck by Beatrix Potter. I'm really interested in the latent content. There's a friend of mine who jokes with me. He's like, you're really into latent content, into latent things. And the thing about Jemima Kennard was there's all kinds of subtle, dark stuff going on that I don't think Beatrix Potter was even fully aware of. Her work is really brilliant. I feel like she exposes a lot about her sort of virginal Edwardian sensibility. A lot gets exposed in her work that I don't think that she was actually even aware of. So there's something really salacious I find in her work, which is strange because she's seen as this person who did cute little bunny drawings.
Sure, yeah.
But there's a lot of weird stuff going on there. And I think in a lot of children's literature, I'm certainly not the first by any means to recognize the dark elements in fairy tales and things like that. But telling new stories for audiences by using old children's... The thing I'm working on now is Hansel and Gretel, and looking at that and looking at the hidden meanings in there, and what does that have to say to a contemporary American audience, and can it be about whiteness? That's what I'm really interested in right now. So I've got a bucket list as a playwright. I don't really have one as an actor anymore now that I've been cast in Amadeus.
Like, done.
Yeah, exactly.
Done and done. What advice do you have for young theater artists?
I try not to give advice to young artists because one thing that I think I've learned in my relatively short career is that it all works out it just all works out. You have to make a bunch of mistakes, you know, to learn, you know. If I had advice, I would just say, just do your thing when you do it. And when you don't. And you'll, you know, because the thing is, when we get into the advice game, there's advice that's like, write every day. My advice is write every day and then don't write for a year, right? Do whatever moves you, you know, because the fact is the whole life is a creative thing. Our whole life is this creative work of art. And there's no reason to put pressure on yourself to do a bunch of stuff. You know, if you want to be a playwright, write plays. If you want to be an actor, act in plays. And let yourself make mistakes and let yourself have an ego. Let yourself have an ego. Have your ego, or it's going to have you. Those are your choices, right? And I've only learned very recently to just actually own my diva and own my ego and own that, because all of the artists I admire most have huge egos and are a little bit of a diva. And I see that that actually gives them a great deal of freedom to achieve what they want as artists. That's my advice for young artists. Have an ego.
I love that advice.
Yeah, and love your ego and let your ego inspire you toward greatness. There we go.
That's just about perfect, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So, go see Is She Dead Yet at Annex Theater, running July 31st through August 22nd. Info at annextheater.org. Check out what the Siegel Project is doing, and that's thesiegelproject.org. And then Amadeus is opening when?
Amadeus is opening in January of 2016 at Seattle Public Theater.
Seattle Public Theater. We'll have the info in the episode description as well. Thank you so much for being a guest. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.